Today on Misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel.
I was the number one retail commodity broker in the world. I was the number one bookmaker in the world. ESPN came to my home and had some sources that knew that I was receiving wires from Shohei Ohtani. Feds raided me on October 5th, 2023. I had about 800 clients active. Every Monday, I would say I was moving $5 to $7 million throughout the country. From the outside, everyone was like, well, how do you get tired of jumping on a plane and G550 and flying to Vegas and having a butler and 10,000 square foot room and, you know, millions of dollars, and I'd buy her whatever she wanted. She didn't care about that stuff. She wanted to have her husband and her family.
Right.
That day on October 5th was one of the best days of my life when the feds raided my home.
Why?
Because I was at a fork in the road.
There is a chance this could be the biggest cover-up in Major
there
League Baseball history. There are names you hear in the news that become bigger than the human behind them. Matt Boyer is one of those names. He's been called the bookie at the center of the Shohei Ohtani scandal, the man who handled hundreds of millions in bets, the guy whose operation stretched from California to Costa Rica and pulled in celebrities, athletes, and an interpreter who shook Major League Baseball to its core. But behind the headlines is a man who on August 29th was sentenced to 12 months and a day in federal prison, a man who now counts down the days until October 10th, when he must walk into a prison cell and leave everything and everyone behind for the next year of his life. He's been ordered to pay back $1.6 million, sit in counseling, and serve out supervised release when he comes home. His empire has crumbled, and yet his story isn't over. Matt flew here to Florida to sit down with me face to face in what will be one of his last interviews before surrender. And while he's spoken to media before, I want you to understand why this conversation is different. Because we're not just going to talk about what he did, we're going to talk about who he is. We'll go back to his childhood, to the early rush of gambling, to what drew him into a life where risk and reward blurred until it consumed him. We'll walk through the rise of his operation, the players involved, the infamous Ohtani connection, and the moment when it all came crashing down. And then we'll talk about the fear, the accountability, and the preparation of a man who is about to lose his freedom in order to begin again. This isn't just another retelling of a scandal. This is about what happens when the lights fade, when the noise of the headlines disappears, and when a man is forced to reckon with himself. Matt Boyer is here, and this is the conversation you haven't heard yet. Matt, thank you so much for joining me today on Misunderstood.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm so happy. I got a chance to meet you a couple weeks ago, which was such an honor to meet you and your wife. I had a great time with you, and you've actually flown into Florida to do this episode, and I'm so excited. Since the time we've met, you've actually been sentenced.
That's correct.
I want to talk about that. I remember texting you, I think it was the morning you went in or the morning before, because I was thinking about it a lot. I know you must have been awake very early thinking about it. Can you talk me through that morning?
Sure.
And what it was like in the courthouse?
I slept 2 hours. Mm-hmm. I put it on my Instagram, 2 hours and 30 minutes, which I don't even know how I did that. But the anxiety was just mounting. Again, as a father of five, it's not about going to prison. I mean, that's a shitty thing to deal with anyway, but it's not being able to be a father and being a husband.
Yeah.
So the realization of all of that is really like, it's weird. I describe to people, if you have to go get a tooth pulled at the dentist, it's like, oh, it's 6 weeks from now. It's no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the day of, you're like, oh, this is, now I got to deal with this, right? It's that times 1,000.
Yeah.
And so the anxiety of like the unknown and just wanting to get it over with is really what gets people.
right.
these situations.
And the not knowing also of the sentencing itself, like how long this could be. So what were you up for? What was the worst that could have happened that day?
Really 37 to 51 months.
Okay.
My max charges are 18 years, but it's always unrealistic. Because I have no charges from priors, I've never been arrested in my life. And the fact is I did cooperate with the government in regards to pleading guilty immediately. I mean, that alone helps you, right? If you don't make them spend money to fight, mm-hmm. then they immediately give you some, I'm gonna call it grievance. Mm-hmm. And that helps you. And then also there was a situation which we can get into, but the case involves casinos. Mm-hmm. And I tried to help them, assist them, the United States government, that is, with just being completely honest with them about that.
Right.
I didn't want to disclose anything else in my phone, but as far as the casinos and the KYC rules and stuff that they were supposed to follow, I was very upfront and honest about that. Okay. So that assisted me and got me a better situation. And then the government recommended 15 months before I walked in.
Right, I saw that, yeah.
And my probation report came back at 41 months. So that's always higher generally in these federal cases mm-hmm. because they don't really factor in all of the things I just discussed. So my attorney pretty much knew 15 months was kind of the worst case, even though I could have got 3 or 4 years.
Right.
Because most judges, as long as you're not completely, you know, out of line and you're doing things that are
right
to mitigate, they're going to give you roughly that range.
And you didn't have any real victims, right?
Correct.
So, I mean, that must have played a big part in it.
That did. And then I paid all of my restitution in full, which less than 1% of people in my case ever do that.
Okay.
7% even pay restitution.
What did you have to pay?
It was a little over $1.6 million.
Okay.
$1.6 and change, which I paid 2 months in advance.
Okay.
And also, I mean, every format I could do to mitigate, I did. I worked with a nonprofit. I went to USC and spoke to kids who are, you know, graduating college or about to, and worked with them on just understanding, I would say, not only addiction, but just overcoming adversity and how do you handle situations. And
yeah.
So I've done things to show also community service to show the judge and the prosecution that I've been reformed.
Right. What were the actual charges?
10 years for money laundering, mm-hmm. 5 years for a falsified tax return, and 3 years for bookmaking.
Okay. And you pled guilty to all of those?
Correct. 3 counts.
Okay. Let's spool back. I want to know how you got here, sure. right? Or got there where they were accusing you of these things.
Right.
Where were you born? Tell me about your childhood and how you got into this.
Ironically, I was born in Cypress, California.
Okay.
I lived basically by a golf course called the Navy Golf Course. Uh-huh. Where a gentleman named Tiger Woods played all the time.
Okay.
And
I think I've heard of him.
Yeah, you've heard of him. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but I used to play there, and that's where I would actually see him as a kid, but we're the same age. You know, so where I grew up was North Orange County, beautiful area. I lived a very, I would say, fantasy childhood mm-hmm. for the first 12 years of my life. And then my dad, who was a Vietnam vet, who owned he is an entrepreneur, owned a couple of businesses, and he was a bail bonds owner.
Oh, wow.
Ironically. Yeah, which is really funny considering what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then he owned an air tool supply company. So because there was no internet then, he was required to stay home and answer the phone.
Ah.
Because Yellow Page ads, there's no other way to get a hold of someone. So he developed a really bad drinking problem to the point where he's drinking 40 beers a day. And my mom, over time, just got over that because it got worse and worse. Sure. So after like 3 or 4 rehabs, they split up. And so at 12 years old, I had my first taste of like reality, you know, where the rug gets pulled out. And
you had to become the man of the family, essentially?
Yeah, I was almost a therapist. Because my two older brothers were, one was graduating high school, one was in high school, and they're doing their own thing. And frankly, they didn't care. I mean, they cared, but you know what I mean? They're off with their
parents. Affected them differently because their age was different. One was getting out of the house, but you are still there and with your mom.
Correct.
Yeah.
And then I had my little brother who was 8, didn't understand, obviously. So I was kind of like in fact, there was times where my dad would call drunk and my mom would just hand the phone to me because she tried and tried and he wasn't listening. And then he would, you know, he wanted to come back. So that was kind of traumatic. I didn't realize until later in life. Mm. And But what it made me do is watch my mom just become a complete hardworking hustler to keep us in that house. She was working three jobs, kidney dialysis technician, selling Jaffa products, making cakes. I mean, anything she could to hustle to feed four boys. Because my dad was just like going off the deep end as far as chasing women and just drinking and, you know, really was non-existent. And it was tough because my mom was just fighting just to keep us going, you know? So I watched this and I decided to start hustling myself.
Right.
So I developed as an Orange County paper boy. Then I started selling the Orange County Register. And then I was hustling with baseball cards. And then I started taking a little bit of bets here and there. And
right.
Started running a poker ring. So all these little things I was doing while my mom was out working. And then I started making literally almost as much money as her at like 16.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So wait, I want to hear about this. Running a poker ring as a teenager. How does that even work?
So...
And was it with kids your own age?
Yeah, they were mostly kids.
And are we talking about dollars they're playing with?
No, the amounts were like $400 or $500, which at a 16, and this is 1991.
Well, that's a lot of money for kids that age now.
It's even a lot now.
Yeah.
But then it was even more.
So, but were they stealing it from their parents? Was this their allowance?
This is what happened. So as I kept building this little poker ring, the neighborhood kids would, you know, come by and give me baseball cards or any other items that they could because they didn't have cash.
Oh.
So I started building other items. And then one of the kids had a little IOU in his pocket. So his mom did his laundry and it said, I owe $340 to Matt. And so then we had an intervention at my house with all the moms.
No way.
Yeah, it was like four of them. My mom was not happy.
Oh my God. Yeah. So what happened? They were like, you need to stop, or they're like, you need to get help.
Stop.
Okay.
Because I was winning and doing well.
Got it.
And to be honest, these kids were losing way more money than they could afford.
So did the parents see you as like just a bully that was taking kids' money, or did they see you as having a gambling problem? Like what were they trying to get at, do you think?
They were more concerned with what their kids were doing.
Right.
Which was
okay.
Losing. They didn't tell me this, but I think they respected that I was running a business.
Right.
But they definitely knew that I was out hustling most of the kids.
Got it.
Because I was always finding ways to win. And then the baseball cards also was another way to hustle, because I would go around the neighborhood. And when I was delivering the paper when I was young, I would say, oh, hey, let's say you're out front with your cards.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hey, Bob, you got some baseball cards. Do you want to do some trading? And then they, oh, sure. I'd go home and get the box of these crap cards that are worth nothing. And I'd say, I'll give you this entire box if you let me just go through your collection and I'll just take eight. And then I'd go through the collection and get Ken Griffey Jr. and Mark McGuire rookies that are worth, you know, $10 or $12, and giving them a 3 cent baseball card, a bunch of them.
Right.
I'd think this big box, and obviously I'd have myself a nice collection of cards, which I ended up selling and buying a truck later at 16.
No way.
Yeah, I never, because I didn't want to ask my mom for money.
Explain why baseball cards are so, like, you can make so much money on them. And you can do this now. I mean, I've seen storefronts in Manhattan that only sell baseball cards. It's shocking to me. I don't get it at all.
It's just the value of, like, obviously, they're rare items, the older ones in particular. So the value of these cards just continue to go up. Just kind of like no different than a Rolex.
Got it.
And, of course, over time, they get ruined. And then the value of those cards go down. So the nice, they call mint condition ones, become more valuable.
Got it.
And so...
But are you saying that only a few companies made Derek Jeter's card?
Correct.
Or whatever?
Especially back then.
Okay.
And then over time, more companies come in and try to, you know, create baseball cards, and there's more of a flood of them, and the value of those cards are less. But all the older ones, yeah, you can't reprint them.
Got it.
You know, you can't go make a card from... Like you said, Derek Jeter's rookie card from, let's call it 1992.
Yeah.
You can't reproduce that.
Right. So, I've never understood this collector items things. Like, I remember, do you remember when Beanie Babies became a thing?
Yeah.
And people were like, you can't cut the tag off, and it's going to be worth so much money. Yeah.
There's been those dolls, too. And
right.
Even like, just look at collector cars, right? Like a 1966 Chevy, this, that.
Yeah.
I'm not a car guy. Well, I'm a Rolls Royce guy.
Right.
But
who
older
isn't?
Cars, you know, those I'm not into, but I do see why the value of those. You can't reproduce them. You can't make them. It's got the, especially the ones that have like ultimate perfect leather from 19, whatever.
Sure.
I get that. But that's kind of the similar thing.
Got it. Yeah. How did gambling make its way into your life then, besides that became a real thing?
I grew up going to the racetrack with my grandparents. My grandma and grandpa loved to gamble. Mm-hmm. You know, nothing crazy. We'd just go and have fun. And they were pretty well off. So we would go to this nice restaurant at Los Alamitos Racetrack, which is real close to Cypress. And mm-hmm. We would get a nice restaurant and then we would gamble and they'd throw me like dollar trifectas or exactas. So I just started learning it.
Right.
And then we'd also play money gamble for Yahtzee. Family game.
Yeah.
You don't mess around.
I have it. I love it. I played that $2. And Boggle. Okay. Those were the things we played growing
up.
But
you probably didn't play for money.
No.
We were.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10 years old. And so it was like in part of our family, you know,
sure.
But it wasn't nothing crazy, nothing mm-hmm. to where I took it. And it was just, I just enjoyed it. I love to add something to a game mm-hmm. and we're a very competitive family. So my brothers and I would get in full fist fights over, you know, matches of Sega Genesis or Nintendo, you know?
Yeah.
And so with four boys in a household with basically a single mom, you can imagine what was going on.
Right, right. So did you go to college? Did you study something?
I never had that chance.
Okay, so when you were younger, who did you think you were going to become? What did you want to be?
To be honest, I always thought I'd be a stockbroker.
Okay.
Which kind of became one, but in commodities.
Right, in commodities.
But my target of becoming a stockbroker was derailed by having a baby and getting my ex pregnant, or my ex-wife, who we're now we have three beautiful girls together.
But, uh-huh.
She got pregnant at 18. So I was having a baby at 19 years old. So college was not an option.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you were a dad.
I was becoming a dad and I didn't even understand what I was going to do for myself, let alone raising a child.
Right. And so you became a commodities trader. How did that come about?
So when I was 18.
Can you just get like the training for that and go into it? You don't have to be a college graduate.
No, you can. You can. Yeah, you can. You have to pass a series three exam.
Okay.
But I'll fast forward. When I was 18, when we found out she was pregnant, we lived on our own in an apartment in Huntington Beach, California, and we were broke. I was working two jobs and all my ends meet, I would gamble away anyway. So.
Oh, okay. So by then you were gambling.
Yeah, small, but yes. Okay. And I mean, gambling never left, mm-hmm. no matter what. It was either $50 or I was betting on something.
Got it.
My whole life. Until today, of course, I don't. But at that age, if I had $20 extra, I would gamble it, you know, just because I always felt like I could turn 20 into 500 or whatever.
Right.
But at 18, when she got pregnant, I had to really grow up. So we decided to, my mom lost the home that we lived in, I would say I was probably just turning 18 maybe. So she moved into a mobile home park in Dana Point, California. And it was very demoralizing for me because I always envision mobile home parks as trailer trash.
Yeah.
That word. I mean, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean you are, but that's how I envisioned it. So mm-hmm. at 18, she moved in there with my little brother in a two bedroom. And once she got pregnant, Monica did, I decided we have to figure this out. I need to get a real job. But to do that, we're going to have to move back in with my mom. So we were sleeping on the couch. And here I am with this like $400 beater car. My girlfriend is pregnant. I don't even have a job really. And I had to figure it out quick.
Yeah.
So I went to the local area that was opening a restaurant. I said, I'll just be a waiter because waiters at 18, they can make pretty decent money.
Sure.
Enough to, you know, support a baby. So I walk in this restaurant. The GM's like, I can hire you, but as a busboy, you have no waiting experience. And I'm like, a busboy? I'm going to serve chips and salsa because it was a Mexican restaurant. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, you can work your way up. So I said, all right, I'll take the job. I need a job. So I started making more money in tips than the waiters because my personality was charismatic and whatever they screwed up on or didn't provide, I would go do it.
Right.
I didn't serve food. And in that, the reason I did that was number one, that's who I am anyway. But number two, I saw it's a very affluent area.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw like guys coming in with nice watches and attractive wives. And you could just feel there was money.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, this is
what I want.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I built relationships in that 3 or 4 months to the point where people were coming in asking to sit in my section, but I didn't have a section. I was a busboy. So the GM's like, okay, I'll promote you soon. And by the time he went to promote me, this couple kept coming in and they said, the wife actually told me, she's like, you know, you're really good. Why don't you come work for us? And I said, sure, I'll take it. I don't care what it is. I'll take the job. And they're like, well, no, you got to interview and you don't even know what it is. Come see for yourself. So
right.
I go to Marshall's and I get a cheap tie because I don't even have one. And I drive in my beater car to Irvine, California. Mm-hmm. And I walk into this amazing opportunity. And what I envisioned was, well, I didn't even know what I was walking into, but what I saw was Wolf of Wall Street, but legal. Guys were just screaming in excitement and, like, you know, had headsets on, and I don't even know what they're doing. I didn't care. But I saw all these Ferraris and Mercedes parked out front in this beautiful corporate building.
Yeah.
And I walk in, and the gentleman I met, his name was Mickey. He was 28 years old. They had everything you would want, a beautiful wife, all the jewelry, the nice watches. He had a Ferrari, and I knew he had lived in a nice house. I mean, you just knew. Mm-hmm. But he lived in, like, a crazy home in Bear Brown Ranch, and he's 28 years old. And I'm like, this is what I want.
Yeah.
I always loved money, and I was always fascinated by it. And the reason I want to be a stockbroker is because I love the movie Wall Street, and I just love that environment. So here I am almost in that same path that I envisioned, that I wanted. But he sits me down, and the interview goes really bad. It's a whole different person. It was, why didn't you go to college? Why did you knock up your girlfriend? You don't have a job. He was belittling me. And after the interview, I was just like, no way I'm getting this job. But he called me back. Came back for another interview, and throughout the interview, I basically started standing up for myself. I said, listen, there's nobody here that's going to work harder than me. I promise you that I have more grind, grit, determination than anyone here. So if you want to give me a job, great. If not, you can tell me what I didn't accomplish in my life.
Right.
So he respected that and gave me the job. But the job was $1,200 a month, 60 hours a week as a mailroom boy. So I'm like, okay, this is not the job I wanted, but it's a start.
Right.
So what I realized, or what I didn't realize, is that I was his personal assistant. So I had this mentor, this invaluable, you know, learning curve, sponging all this.
Right.
So I worked for him directly, and then I just learned. I started studying the Series 3 exam on the side. I was first contact to the company, so every phone call that came in would be transferred to the broker, and I would be the one transferring it. So I would just stay on the phone and hit mute and listen to the sales calls. So I just started getting all this education.
Got it.
And long story short, I'm going to fast forward. At 20 years old, I got promoted to working for the top broker. Mm-hmm. And then about a year later at 21, I went and opened a discount company for him, a brand new firm, because he trusted me. Mm-hmm. And then I was making $700,000 a year at 21 years old.
Wow.
Which was amazing because I had this opportunity that arose. My parents' home that they lost, or my mom, it came up for sale. And at 21 years old, I bought it
for
$540,000.
Oh,
and I moved back into my parents' home. It was very weird because my dad's room had, from cigarette smoke, 3 packs a day, it was like brown. Literally, the walls went from white to brown. And when I moved back into the house, obviously someone else purchased it. So it was a little different. So I painted the whole house and moved in. I have a 2-year-old girl, a little baby girl now. And I'm 21, I have a Mercedes, I have all these things, and I'm just like, my life is going the right direction. And I move into this house, and I have the perfect life, in my opinion, right? So, of course, the problem is I love to gamble.
Right.
And so my gambling addiction starts kind of getting bigger and bigger, to the point where I'm like, you know, all these guys, I keep losing money to bookies. I wasn't really good at sports betting. And I have all these guys in this office that make a lot of money. Because I'm in this environment of Wolf of Wall Street. But I'm a family guy, so I don't do drugs. I've never done drugs. And I don't really drink a ton, but I love to gamble. But all these guys do all of this stuff, and they do it to the max. They gamble, they do hookers, they do cocaine, they do it all.
Right.
You know, because that's not all of them, but a lot of them. So I saw an opportunity. I said, why don't I just take their bets? I'm tired of losing myself. I can't win doing this, so let's just take their bets. So I started taking their bets. They're betting a lot of money, and I was making a lot of money. So I started making very good money. And I'm like, this is business here, you know? And then all of a sudden the internet comes along. And when the internet comes along, I see an opportunity to scale it. So I'm one of the first bookmakers to go down to Costa Rica and set up a shop down there and actually scale the business.
Okay, wait, I want to slow down for 1 second. Couple questions. Spool back. What happened with your mom and the mobile home?
My mom, when I moved into my home, she met a man, and he's amazing. They're still married to this day.
Oh, I love that. Okay.
Yeah, he's a retired fire battalion chief, and he swept her off her feet, and she's living the best life.
Okay. Love hearing that.
Yeah.
There is a world of opportunity out there beyond the typical 9-to-5 where purpose and grit and the American spirit come together in the Peace Corps. It's been called the toughest job you'll ever love. Tough because it asks so much of you. And the love part is knowing your hard work can transform lives and build bridges across cultures. After 65 years, the Peace Corps is still the toughest job you'll ever love. Explore opportunities in more than 60 countries and apply at peacecorps.gov/serve. That's peacecorps.gov/serve. I'm curious why you picked your old house to buy when you could buy whatever you wanted. Do you think there's something psychological about that?
Yeah, it was like the... To this day, it was the fact that my mom lost it. She fought for that thing so hard. And I know the feeling because I have a very similar situation now. I live in a $5 million home in San Juan Capistrano, California. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a position where I have to try to maintain and keep my family in that house.
Right.
So I'm like reliving my mom's situation.
Right.
Self-induced. But it's a tough situation because I'm trying, struggling right now to keep my kids in private school. I just got my daughter through Oregon. That was like $300,000 to get education and all that stuff. And I can't lose this house. You know, it's more like, if anything, I want to buy a bigger house. You know,
right.
I don't want to go backwards.
No, I understand.
So that dogfight is actually happening now. But to answer your question, it was pride. I wanted like to kind of get that back. And I only lived there probably a year, year and a half. And then we moved our company from Irvine to Aliso Viejo. So it was too long of a drive. Mm-hmm. So I lived there about a year and a half. I sold the house. I think I took a small loss on it, actually. But it was so much pride and just happiness of buying this house.
And she must have been proud, too.
She was, yeah. It was really, I mean, to be 21, buying a piece of property and having Mercedes and all the guys in my neighborhood. I wanted to be back in my neighborhood, even though it wasn't, it was a little bit of a drive to work. But
yeah.
I wanted them to kind of see what I've accomplished.
You know? Right.
I was really proud of myself.
I love that story. Okay, you were talking about taking bets. So up until this time, you are gambling on your own. You see that other people are doing it and you're losing money. Were you using a bookie? When you were placing bets, because I want people that are listening to understand the whole process of placing a bet, how it works, who's involved, right. All that stuff.
From 16 to, let's call it 21, mm-hmm. I was always betting with a bookie.
Okay. And are bookies a legal job? A legal job. Sorry, it sounded.
They've become legal in some states.
Okay.
But the reality is there's no legal bookies because they're only now entities or corporations like FanDuel and DraftKings.
Oh, right. Okay.
They will never allow, oh, I shouldn't say never. I don't believe they will ever allow a regular Joe, me, you, or whoever to open a bookmaking operation. They'll only give it to these conglomerate corporations because they control all the license.
Got it. And I've noticed that with some of those, even with DraftKings or whoever it is, you can only certain states can participate in those, right?
Yeah, 38 states as of now.
Okay.
California, where I live, still is a no and probably will be for another 2 years.
But like I live in Florida and I tried to place a bet for like a Kentucky Derby thing on some site.
Okay.
And they said I couldn't because I was in Florida.
Correct.
So is Florida one of the ones you cannot place a bet at all or just with some certain companies?
I don't live here, so I'm not positive on the statement, but I'm pretty sure that Florida is still a state you cannot sports bet.
Got it.
I'm almost sure it is. But
okay.
Of course, there's casinos here, just like there are in California.
So it's legal within the casino, but not even. Still, okay.
Like these, they're Indian reservations here.
Okay.
Hard Rock and is Indian. In California, it's Pechanga. They're all Indian reservations. They can take, you know, baccarat, blackjack, et cetera, but no sports bets.
Got it.
Yeah.
Is that all Indian reservation casinos?
Yeah.
So like you go to Mohegan Sun, but I thought there's like sports books, betting.
You can. Mohegan Sun is in Connecticut.
Yeah.
And you can gamble on sports there, so they can take sports books.
I see.
But here in Florida, it doesn't matter if it's Indian, not zero chance.
Got it. So first it's a state rule and then it's within the casino itself.
Okay. Exactly.
All right. So to place a bet, mm-hmm. you have to use a conglomerate or a bookie.
A legal entity, yes.
Right.
Illegal would be a bookmaker, which is what I was doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you build a relationship with someone on the streets, let's mm-hmm. call it, and you bet through their website as opposed to a FanDuel or DraftKings.
Got it. So your website would be competing essentially with
absolutely
those. Okay. And how do you, within your website, how are you creating that to make the bet go through? Like, how does that actually work?
So in Costa Rica or Carousel or Bahamas or Aruba, there's mostly Costa Rica. there's a million different operations that facilitate all of that for a bookmaker in the United States.
I see.
And going back to when I was younger, as I was telling you earlier, I was one of the first guys to go down to Costa Rica and establish that relationship so that I could actually scale my business. But now it's everyone has them and they're everywhere. So there's a million bookies in the United States.
Yeah.
Illegal bookies. Truly, there's a million. And they're all using mostly Costa Rica. And
got it.
They facilitate, they're a hub because it's legal there. And as long as the money is not transacted in Costa Rica, then even if it is, they don't care. It's legal.
Right.
But the bottom line, this is where it's illegal. If the money goes, let's say it goes to Costa Rica mm-hmm. and it comes back to the U.S., it's still illegal because it's in the U.S. But if it's in Costa Rica, like there are legal bookmakers in Costa Rica that you could send money to. And it's legal because it's in Costa Rica. But if they ever set foot here in the U.S., they're going to have a problem.
Okay. And also explain, do people need to know you personally to place a bet? Or like someone like me could just find your website and place a bet that way?
No,
does it work that way?
Not.
Okay.
You will, great question. You will definitely need to know somebody in my organization.
Got it.
To even get access to the website.
Got it.
The website is there. You could check it out, but you won't have a PIN and password to log in.
I see. Okay. So now explain to me about the cash flow that's going in and out. Some bookies, you have to pay up front or never?
Nowadays, more than before.
Okay.
I would say if you fast forward back 10 years ago, credit was just given much easier.
Okay.
Because the world was different.
Right.
You're going back to, I was not involved when the mob was around. I mean, kind of at the tail end of my life, I dealt with some people in the mob, but it was like dissipating because of cameras and federal government and everything. So credit was given and people paid more.
Okay.
Nowadays, people are very keen to just say, no, thank you. I'm not paying you that's in a nice format. And they just don't pay. There's more people that stiff now than ever in history of sports betting.
And because it's illegal, you can't actually go after them unless you're like physically doing some harm and threats. Yeah. And this is how you see all in the movies that people are getting killed or threats against their family or whatever.
Correct. And bookmakers smart bookmakers nowadays don't ever have violence or put their hands on people because they realize they're A, going to end up in the same shoes I'm in.
Yeah.
Or B, they're going to ruin their business because the feds are going to get called.
Right.
So they really just learn to let it go. And now it's about vetting your customer better.
Got it. Okay. But why, how do you vet a customer? I mean, listen, if we're talking about $1 million on a bet, I'm assuming you make them do a smaller bet beforehand so you know they're good for it, or you check their credit. I don't really know how that works.
Well, no, it's kind of all of the above. So the first thing I look at is who's referring me the business.
Okay.
You know this as well as anyone. Mm-hmm. The circle of your friends are usually, if you're running in a circle of Jeff Bezos' friends, like he's probably going to be, one of his friends is probably not going to not pay you.
Right.
They probably have the money.
Right.
But if you're taking wagers from a guy who, nothing wrong with this, but you work at Taco Bell, he's probably going to be less likely to pay you a big balance. So you
right.
give
I see
that
what
kind
you're
of
saying.
Credit.
Yeah.
That being said, it comes down to the relationship of who's referring who.
Okay.
If that person is somebody who's always been honorable and, we have a really good relationship, I'm going to be more keen to give more credit to whoever he brings in.
Right.
Of course, we're going to have a conversation. All right. Who is John? What's he do? And why are you referring him to me?
Right.
Why does he need a bookie?
It also makes the guy look bad if, if I refer someone and this guy stiffs you, that's humiliating to me too. Yeah. So you want to keep those circles
100%
close and honest.
Because I'm going to call you and say, Rachel, you referred me, Bob here, what's the deal with this guy? I mean, I've only known him for 2 years, but he seemed great. And, he's got 8 gas stations or whatever you told me. And I'm like, well, he's not paying me. What's going on? But that vetting is so important. And it's actually the most important thing, because if I give credit to somebody and they beat me for money, which has happened many times, and I pay them, now the money's gone. And if they lose and they don't pay me, I'm not getting that money back.
Exactly. That's why I would think that this is a very scary thing for you, because if you are the bookmaker or whatever you call it, the guy holding the book, it's on you to come up with the money if you lose, no matter what. And you don't know 100% of the time that you're going to get that money. And it's like taking from Peter to pay Paul and to make sure. Okay. So when you started it, going back to where you said you were working with these guys and you saw an opportunity, Did you offer them credit too, or were they giving you money in advance? Like, how did that all start?
These guys, first of all, I worked with them. Mm-hmm. I knew what kind of money they made, and we had relationships, so I wasn't worried about that. In fact, if they didn't pay, we would completely make a fool of them in there in the office.
Right.
So that was easy. But it's once I started going outside of that tree where the issues started arising, right? Because he's referring his buddy from college, and you know, he claims he's got money, but he really doesn't.
Right.
There's a lot of people in the world, as you know, that floss and act as if they do, and they really don't.
Right.
Especially in where I live in Orange County.
Right. I would say the majority of people act like they have something.
I agree with that.
Yeah, see, go ahead.
that's the truth. So you're hoping that you're getting customers that aren't that way, of course.
Yeah.
And you have to minimize the damage when it is occurring by, like you said earlier, maybe I give a guy wants to bet $5,000 a game and maybe a $100,000 credit line, but the referral's not strong. So I'll say, hey, you can put up $50,000 and you can get that credit line, or I'll let you bet $2,000 a game and I'll give you $20,000 in credit to start. Let's do some transactions first. Let's kind of get to know each other. And I want you to see that I pay too.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know me from Adam, right? So what if I don't pay you?
Right.
Obviously, I've come highly recommended, but let me prove to you that I pay.
Right.
You know, and that's really an excuse to say, let me make sure you pay.
Right, right. Okay, so just so that people understand the level of what you are doing, can you tell me, like, how many people were working for you? What kind of sports you guys were betting on? And on any given day, are you watching everything from soccer, baseball, basketball, whatever, and you're dealing with hundreds of people and bets? Or, like, how are you managing all this in your head?
When the feds raided me on October 5th, 2023, I had about 800 clients active.
Okay.
I had probably 1,200, but only 800 were actively betting. The other 400 probably owed me quite a bit of money, and they're on pause.
Okay.
to be honest. But they would come back if I was still in the business. That being said, every Monday, I would say I was moving $5 to $7 million throughout the country.
Wow.
And I had 48 agents throughout the country that worked under me. To explain what an agent is, it's someone who doesn't want to take the exposure or the risk that I was, but wants to be part of the business. So let's pretend that you live in Florida, you're about to be married, maybe he gambles, maybe he has 10 friends that do. You would contact me and say, hey, I want to make some money off these guys. They're going to gamble anyway. I'll set all 10 of them. Mm-hmm. I'd set up 10 accounts for you. Mm-hmm. You'd give them all PIN and passwords. They would gamble through my site. You would collect or pay them with my money. You know, if they won, I would send you the money, you would pay them. If they lost, let's just say for argument's sake, they lost $100,000 for the week, you would give me my piece, which is anywhere from 50. You would keep 50 to 10%, depending on how much work you did.
Sure, sure.
So let's just pretend for argument's sake, you got 40%. You would obviously send me $60,000. You would keep $40,000 for that week, and everybody would pay you.
Okay, so it wasn't that you were necessarily going all over the country looking for people to work for you. It was that eventually you would find people that said, hey, I can bring in this kind of business. I don't want to be the big man, but I will be your intermediary.
Correct.
Or whatever. Okay, yep. I see. Now, can they get in trouble for that?
Yes.
Okay. Definitely. And has anyone gotten in trouble for that, or they all disappeared? No, I mean in your situation.
No, not one person. I wouldn't give up one person, one of my agents to the government.
But how are they making a living now?
Honestly, I think a few of them got scared and shut it down.
Okay.
I would say majority of them just went right to the next book, you know, literally bookmaker.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Instead of calling me, they just went to John down the street. And
does that make you resentful that there are so many other bookmakers that didn't get in trouble or don't get in trouble?
I want to answer this honestly. I'm not a victim, and I definitely am accountable for my actions, but it's frustrating to see some people that are still out there making tons of money doing what I was doing. And, you know, I'm no longer able to do so.
Right.
If I was able to, if they allowed me to have a license, then I would be happy to do this business and give the government their piece and just do exactly what DraftKings and FanDuel are doing, but it's not going to happen.
So, but now explain that too for people that are listening. How could you do this in a legal way? Like DraftKings is owned by not one person.
I think it's a publicly traded company.
Right.
Now. But yeah, so to get that license, you're going to have to be some conglomerate and you're going to have to know some congressman or this or
right.
that.
Right. Okay. So it's not as easy as anybody thinks it
is. Here's a good example. Is marijuana allowed here in Florida?
I don't smoke it. I think so. Yes.
Okay. So they only give so many licenses.
Okay.
Same thing in California. And to get a license is very difficult.
Okay.
It's usually, I don't want to say how people get licensed, but I believe it has to do with a little bit of money under the table and this and that. And I believe that that's sadly how this all works. I mean, FanDuel and DraftKings, I'm not saying they went and slipped somebody money, but it's clearly they have relationships and you and I are never, I don't want to say never, probably unlikely ever going to be able to get a gaming license to be a sportsbook.
But I mean, it's not like you could go translate this and become the CEO of DraftKings.
I mean, I could have. So that's why I don't like to play victim. I had that opportunity, just like whoever the CEO is. So I don't want to act like I couldn't have, but I think it would have been very difficult.
Right. Sure. And he's probably prevented from gambling, I would think.
I bet you he's not, but I bet you he doesn't. That's just an assumption.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So now let's get back into your story. And again, as we've talked before, I know that you've talked all about the war stories and all that kind of stuff, but just in a, you know, tell me how much you were making in a week losing and how much you were actually clearing for yourself. Other people that were coming to you, you can name names, not name names, but like what kind of money was, you know, being changed hands.
So the business I was moving, like I said, $5 to $7 million a week, but some weeks I would lose $2 million.
Okay.
The next week I might lose $2 million, and then I'll have the following week I'll win $4 million.
But when you say lose $2 million, did that mean out of all the bets you would be behind $2 million and that would have to come out of your pocket?
Correct.
Because too many people won.
Correct.
Okay. But so not your personal betting.
No, that's different. That's a whole different conversation.
Okay.
We could talk about. But my actual business-wise, over time, would never lose. I mean,
got it.
It was unbeatable the way I ran it, and it's just so hard to win sports betting anyway. I would say, truly, less than 1% over time ever beat sports betting, and I mean as a profession.
Right.
There are people that have runs of they win one whole season or 6 weeks in a row. That happens, but over time, it's really difficult because every bet you make, you're laying 10% in juice or VIG.
Okay.
So just to break that down for someone who doesn't understand it, if you bet $100 on a football game or a basketball game, you have to risk $110.
Okay.
So if you lose the game, you lose $110. If you win, you only win $100, right? So over time, after all these bets, that 10% eats you alive. Because if you go 5-5, you pick 5 winners, 5 losers, you obviously just lost the juice five times.
Right, right.
And that's a whole nother bet. So it's so difficult to overcome that over time. That's why most people lose.
Right.
For my personal betting, I was a wild animal. So I could be on a plane with $2 million every few weeks flying all over the country with my wife and kid and all my kids sometimes and my nanny. And yeah, that was bananas.
So to do all this though, do you have to actually know sports really well or people are just betting based on their gut? I mean, how are people?
You need to know sports. Yeah.
You do.
I mean, you don't have to, I mean, you could run this business and not, but I just don't know anyone that ever has done that.
Right. You know, but you hear all these guys that's sitting around talking about how much they know about sports from their couch or even from TV. Right. But then, you know, if you go back to, Mike Tyson, and that whole fight and how everybody talked about that fight for months leading into it. And then how people still didn't know how to bet because of the age gap and because of the health that was going on with Mike Tyson. And so I'm just curious, like for that bet, for example, were you getting more people to come in on one side versus the other, or was it split down the middle? How did you feel about it?
To be honest with you, the more you know about sports, I think the less chance you have of winning.
Why?
Because the people who actually make money betting sports are MIT nerds that don't even know the game, don't understand it. They're running algorithm robots, simulating the game 100,000
ways. Like Moneyball or whatever that was.
Yeah, it's literally like a Harvard grad kid that, when I say simulates a game, I mean to the point where a person who watches sports and enjoys sports would never waste their time doing that.
Right.
You know, that's not fun for them.
Yeah.
They'd rather say, oh, Josh Allen's the best quarterback, and they'll tell you why. And they know a lot about sports, but there's a reason why the spread is there. You still got to cover the spread.
Right.
And then over time, again, the juice or the VIG is going to eat them alive. So truth be told, I know more about sports than 99% of people. I've watched 8 million games, but I still can't beat it.
Right. Right. And it's funny that you say that because I took part in the college basketball group whatever it was, contest for my fiance's company.
Okay.
So we're talking like 35, 40 people.
Uh-huh.
And I came in number two.
Yeah, that surprised me.
I had never watched college basketball in my entire life.
Was this for the March Madness?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, by the way, it was so much fun because, of course, all of a sudden I was most of the time I was winning until the last day or whatever. And I just thought I knew everything about sports all of a sudden, you know. But I picked based on the colors or if I liked whatever city they or their mascot. I don't know.
It didn't matter. It worked.
Yeah, it worked. So
but that's my point. Like, you don't watch sports all the time.
Right.
You know, and you're not – you don't even know half the players or any of the players probably.
Right.
And these guys watch it every damn game every which way and they can't figure it out.
But I could admit it was fun.
It's exhilarating.
Yeah.
The dopamine rush. And imagine putting – $1 million on a football game
mean,
or whatever, basketball game. It's exhilarating. It truly is.
Right.
I hate to say this, but it's like I've never done ecstasy, but I think for me, I would describe it as like the best sex of your life or the best ecstasy you've ever had. Or,
right.
Heroin even. You know, I've never done heroin, but I hear about these people have done this and the high they feel, the dopamine rush, at least I can speak for myself from gambling. I get that.
Now, I want to ask you about is there any level of responsibility in what you do if you see that one of your clients is an athlete, let's say, and you see that they're betting on their own sport? I mean, I'm assuming that's illegal for them to do.
I can honestly tell you that I've never seen or knew of athlete betting on their own particular sport through me.
Okay.
I've seen many athletes that were betting on other sports and definitely were, you know, gambling. But never like fixing, rigging games. I for sure wouldn't want to be part of that for two reasons. One, I appreciate the integrity of the game.
Mm.
Number two, that's going to get me in trouble.
Right.
And I knew that. And I mean big trouble because they're going to make an impact. If there's a bookmaker that's allowing that to occur and knows of it or even doesn't know of it, really, it's going to be a big problem.
Right.
That person's going to. I got a year and a day. I guarantee you I would have got a lot worse if I was in on something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Before you met Ipe. Is that how you pronounce the name?
Ipe.
Sorry. I'm going to mispronounce that 10 times today. I'm sure. Okay. Ipe. Before you met him, what was life like? What was the business like? Were you doing super well? Did you have all the clients you needed? You had no issues?
I was doing very, very well. Mm-hmm. But of course, another $16 million didn't hurt my situation.
Right.
But yeah, my business was flourishing dramatically. If I never met Ipe, to be honest, I think I'd still be a bookmaker and I think my life would be financially great. But that day on October 5th was one of the best days of my life.
Why?
When the feds raided my home.
Why?
Because I was at a fork in the road, even with my personal relationship with my wife. Like we have the best marriage ever, but she was getting a little run down from the gambling and how much it was overtaking me. Cause I think you're a very similar person. I'm very all in and to the point where my head is down and I almost lose sight of other things.
Yeah.
So I wasn't as present as a husband, as a father that
got it.
I should be. And it kind of ran its course. I mean, we're talking like 20 years of high, high stress gambling and, you know, putting yourself in very interesting situations.
Right.
Part of it, my book describes, you know, a guy pulled a pistol and
yeah.
Who needs that, right? I'm a father of five.
Yeah.
And I toned all of that down. The minute I met my wife, I stopped anything that was kind of gray area. I was in a gray area business, but I meant like shaky. I wouldn't go knock on someone's door anymore. I didn't do any of that. But she was getting really tired of it.
Yeah.
It was funny because from the outside, everyone was like, well, how do you get tired of jumping on a plane and on a G550 and flying to Vegas and having a butler and 10,000 square foot room and, you know, millions of dollars and I'd buy her whatever she wanted. She didn't care about that stuff. I mean, she wanted to have her husband and her family.
Right. Well, at the core, I think, I mean, from the little I know you guys are family people.
Yes,
though.
Very much so.
And somewhere along the line, she got a little bit involved in this. Can you explain to people? Because it was kind of genius that, you know, now that she's traveling with you and doing all this stuff, that she would become part of it.
Yeah. My wife actually enjoyed gambling. And she is a very intelligent woman. Like, one of the things that attracted me to her, aside from the aesthetically the way she looks, which is amazing, but internally, she's like even better person. And her brain she graduated USC. She speaks three languages. She studied abroad in Spain. She's traveled. I mean, there's so many things about her that I could go on and on. And what I realized is that she started asking me business questions about my business as I got to know her more and more, and she got more enthralled in my life.
Right.
And I was impressed with the questions, because there were questions like another bookmaker would ask me.
Got it.
And she would have a better sense. You know, women are, in my opinion, sharper than men. So she would have a better sense of when a guy was going to stiff me before I would. Mm. And I read people very well.
Yeah.
But there would always be like a guy that would, because I'm a salesperson, mm-hmm. sometimes we are the easiest to be sold. Mm-hmm. She would sniff that one out. There's like a two or three guys. She'd be like, I don't feel good about that. And then I'd be like, no, he's cool. He's great. He's this and that. And then stiff.
Right.
Or problem.
Right.
And I'd be like, wow, she just has that that sense, you know?
Right.
So in this process of building our relationship, I started realizing like I'm making all these hosts, all this money. Mm-hmm. Every trip I was going, I was gambling so high. The host would make like $30,000. And I said, you know what? Why don't I pitch the casinos to allow my wife to be a licensed host? Mm-hmm. Because we have a group of gamblers too. All of my customers gamble, my sports bettors,
yeah. right?
And they go to Vegas or wherever. And if my wife can facilitate that and get them comps, et cetera, she can make a living on the side.
Right.
She was already building her clothing brand, but why not?
So is that a normal thing, or were you creating a job that didn't exist?
It's never happened.
Okay.
There's no gambler that I know that has ever had their wife become their host.
Right.
And then, you know, here's the great part about
it. So an independent casino host, that means she could have been one at any casino, not just at one.
Correct.
That's what was different about it.
Yeah,
and she could travel with you guys, and as opposed to you just going to the Venetian or
correct.
Whatever. Okay.
We were able to negotiate deals with throughout the country.
Did she have to give a portion of her proceeds or whatever to a casino host there to work under their umbrella or anything? So it doesn't work.
The only part that was difficult was if I was already established at a certain casino, they wouldn't pay her because I already was going there.
Oh, I see.
So we didn't get licensed at some casinos like Caesars she got licensed Caesars, Palazzo Venetian.
Okay.
Because I had hosts there. I've been going there for years. So they're like, we're not going to pay her when we're already paying our employee to handle you.
Got it.
So there was some logistics, but.
But is there a negative to it that I know when you go to certain casinos, they comp you everything. They send a jet for you. They give you the biggest villa. Because she wasn't associated with that hotel, did they take any of that away?
No, because basically they're going to have to provide that to get my business anyway.
Got it. Okay.
And
so that was the draw.
Yeah. And we would negotiate. Basically, I was going to Resorts World, for example, mm-hmm. was new to me. I've never been there.
Yeah.
So it was easy to make her, you know, a licensed rep through them.
Sure.
Because I would be a brand new customer to them.
Right.
So that part was easy. It's just when you go to some of these other ones that maybe I've been to, but it was been 3 years, then you can negotiate. Listen, he hasn't been there in 3 years. Mm-hmm. So if you want him back, I'll be the host. And so you negotiate stuff like that. But the reason why this was so good is, number one, she was making up to $30,000 just on me alone mm-hmm. per trip. And then of course our entourage, I was bringing 10, 15 players as well. And so she's getting paid on all their play.
Wow.
And then we were negotiating my deals. So, you know, there's no better negotiation when you can do it yourself.
Yeah.
Usually it's you call a host, you tell them what they want. And I'm not talking about rooms and that's all. I get that anyway.
Right.
I'm talking about promo chips, discounts. You know, I would negotiate a 20% discount on my
loss.
That's huge. You go lose $2 million, you're getting $400,000 back.
Yeah.
That's big. Also getting $100,000 in chips walking in the door.
Yeah.
I would get my wife a $25,000 gift card to Crystal Shops.
Right.
I mean, that's a purse or whatever, you know. It's nice to get these little additional things that you would never get without having that, you know, being able to negotiate it.
So what potentially could she be on the hook for? I mean, they haven't come after her yet, or they've taken away her license.
Yeah, she's definitely been, her license is gone.
Okay.
She basically, Nevada Gaming Control Board, who handles that, is possibly coming after her for civil fines mm-hmm. Because they're saying that she allowed her husband to gamble knowing he was an illegal bookmaker.
Got it.
Which is
why I asked that question previously, if there's a morality clause to knowing who you're dealing with. So I
know
see.
Know your customer. Yes.
Know your customer,
and,
yeah.
And apparently she was supposed to know this rule, but that's really the compliance job of the casino.
Got it.
Which is why we are just like up in arms. I'm already dealing with my situation. I'm accountable for my action. I'm going to prison. I paid my restitution. But my wife is not a compliance person.
Okay.
Her job is to come in and bring in guests. Compliance does compliance. So we're baffled by the fact that she all of a sudden, and by the way, I want to paraphrase this. She was supposed to be ran through a course by the casinos,
okay,
which never occurred. So how could she even know these rules when she never even was taught the rules or trained on the rules she was supposed to know, so to speak?
Right. So if we're talking about know thy customer, how come the casinos themselves aren't in trouble?
Well, they kind of are.
Okay.
That's why my case is still ongoing.
Got it.
Even
okay.
though I've advanced my sentencing and I've chosen to move on, and it's costing me time because of it, but—
Oh, but case is not closed.
No.
Oh, okay. Tell me why.
Because know your customer rule was not being followed, and the federal government is currently, I'm going to use the word arguing because I don't know where it's going to go, with Resorts World Casino.
Got it.
And they are both negotiating, I believe, a settlement. But I can't speak on this behalf because they don't tell me and I don't ask, but I pretty much know that that's what's occurring. And I don't know what's going to happen, if it's going to be zero fine or if it's going to get dropped or if it's going to be $50 million.
But your piece is out of it.
Yes.
Okay. So that's going to be between the government and the hotels or the casinos or whatever.
Correct.
And is it just Resorts World, or is it kind of now it's coming down on a lot of casinos that there's got to be plenty of people like you, and why are they not looking into that?
So the Wynn paid $130 million about a year and a half ago. Okay. That was the biggest fine ever.
Relating to what, though? To this situation?
To money laundering, allowing a guest. Yeah, so it's very similar.
Okay.
MGM Mirage Corp paid like $7.5 million.
Wow.
Recently. Mm. And then Resorts World did pay $10.5 million to Nevada Gaming Control Board, which is separate. Mm-hmm. That's the one that's possibly going after Nicole. But the government situation is still outstanding, so I do believe there's going to be a fine there. Some of these other casinos, I think, skated by because, you know, you do need evidence and you need to, et cetera. So I don't know if other casinos will pop up with problems, but as of now, Resorts World, I believe, will be the key to this case and what's where it's going.
Okay, so let's get into now how it all came crashing down.
Sure.
And it seems like when you met
Ipe.
that this became the turning point because what? It got too flashy because the money coming back and forth was more than you had before. How did you get found out?
Truth is, everyone thinks that because of the name Shohei Ohtani and Ipe. That's not even why I got in trouble.
Okay.
It's back to what we just discussed. It's the casinos.
Got it.
They came to me because of the casinos, and then Ipe just happened to unfold. Because as you know, when you uncover something, that's when you find out a little bit more of the story.
Sure.
And they had no idea how big my business really was.
Got it.
And also who—
Meaning, did they think you were coming in as you, as an individual, just being flashy and spending this kind of money there, and you had your wife? Okay, so explain.
They knew I was a bookmaker. They being the federal government and the casinos, let's be real. But I was raided in 2014. I signed an abandonment form. They took some money. Everybody went on their own way. So I don't hurt people. I do pay taxes. So I think they were like, he's not a big enough target. But I became a target. And this is all my assumption, by the way, but I'm pretty close to accurate. They became a target once they went after the casinos. And they saw that I lost $13 million through their casinos, which is a large amount of money. And then clearly they knew that I was a legal bookmaker. So if you're going to get a casino on a charge of not following KYC, here's a perfect candidate for that.
Right.
So I believe that's what led them to my driveway with 29 agents as I put my son in my wife's G-Wagon that morning. But that as far as Ipe and Shohei Ohtani situation, that didn't even come out until later. And that came out because ESPN came to my home and had some sources that knew that I was receiving wires from Shohei Ohtani.
Right.
So then we had to tell the federal government.
So you had to come clean about that because you knew that you were about to be on the news about that.
That's correct.
Got it.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So I actually did not tell them because I didn't want to, as I told you earlier, I didn't want to talk about anyone on my phone.
Yeah.
I made an agreement that I would discuss the casinos and I didn't want to give up any of my agents. I truly—
Or your clients or whatever.
Yeah, I don't want nobody to get in trouble. It's my business. I deserve to fall on the sword. I mean, why would anyone else have to fall with me?
Right. This became a big story because of Ohtani's name.
For sure.
And that's why it became mainstream. It's not just a sports story. It was bigger than that. And I think, too, you know how this Bravo verse, Bravo universe works, that these people sometimes are bigger to the average person than the biggest star. So what I recall is that a couple months ago, whenever it was, there were some episodes that had to do with Jen and Ryan. Right. And, you know, I guess it was Tamra kept saying in a drunken state something around the, you know, along the lines of the FBI have raided you, are gonna raid you. Right. And it was like all this weird questioning, foreboding stuff. And no one really knew what it meant. And then you saw that he was cleared or not really part of it. And I don't know if they talk about it on the show or not, because I don't really watch that. And I don't think they've harped on it that much, but it was a little bit of a storyline. Mm-hmm. So he's not part of this.
No, he's never been part of my business.
Right.
What the reality and the truth is he did receive some wire transfers for me because I was debanked. I wasn't allowed to receive wires. Well, I didn't have a bank account.
Oh, okay. So you needed him as a bank.
He was a friend of mine, mm-hmm. and he was best man at my wedding. And so I needed to throw a wire transfer to somebody because I needed to receive a wire. Mm-hmm. So I asked him, will you take a wire? So he did. As a friend. Mm. And what turned out is we started going to Resorts World together because he gambled with me.
Okay.
And I started losing a lot of money. And then he had a credit line at Resorts World where he was gambling. Mm. And my wife was the host, so we were allowed to give more credit. So I was like, hey, Ryan, let's bump up your credit line. And so we bumped up his credit line. And then guess what? I lost. So the only way to pay that credit line was to send a wire to his bank account to pay the casino.
Got it.
Well, I had the worst run of my life gambling. I've been gambling for 20 years. Mm-hmm. I've never lost this kind of money. I lost $13 million. Mm-hmm. So it just kept adding up, and I just kept losing. So all this money from Shohei Ohtani was being wired in. I just kept losing at the casino like an idiot. Obviously, Tamra.
And when you say that, sorry, just so we all follow, you're getting money and then you're losing money. But you're losing it because you're gambling it for others, or this was the personal loss you were
personal
suffering?
Personal loss.
Okay, yeah. Got it.
And some of it I would use to hedge my business a little bit. Like if a person bets $500,000 in a football game and I liked that football game, meaning I thought I was going to win, I might bet it at the Resorts World Casino.
Got it.
So it's kind of a little bit of a hedge, but never doesn't matter because the government didn't want to hear that.
Yeah.
That being said, Ryan received a bunch of wires and, of course, had nothing to do with my business. But Tamra was alluding that he did. And because he wasn't saying anything, because his attorney told him not to.
Right. And she didn't know the facts. How could she? Which is fine. I mean, right. She probably thought she was onto something.
Correct.
And you can see how he was part of the story, but correct. Not part of the story. So I right. get it.
Yeah. Okay. And I get that, well, there's smoke, there's fire. Mm-hmm. And there was smoke, but there wasn't really fire because he was definitely not part of my organization. She kept saying he's a bookie and, you know, all this stuff.
Got it.
But he did receive some wire transfers, and that is accurate.
Right.
But he has no part of my business. He's never been a bookie. He's never, he really doesn't even
support. Did that affect your friendship?
Yeah, it did. Because, you know, anytime you're in a federal indictment and you're having the government sit, you know, have a colonoscopy up you, it's it's very interesting.
Yeah.
And everyone's nervous and everyone's scared and everyone doesn't know what to do and who to talk to. And
right.
Can you call him? Can you not? So yeah, it's created a little tension between us, but we're friends. It's not like we don't like each other. It's just, we were really, really close. And then Ryan handles stress a lot different than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly I've been under the gun my whole life, really since I've been 12, as far as stress levels.
Yeah.
And I think I handle it very well.
Right.
I don't think he's great at handling stress and in these, well, most people aren't in these situations.
Sure.
So he's reacted a little bit more of a taken back. And so I've been more, as you notice, in front of the charge. I mean, I've just been addressing the truth from day one. My attorneys think I'm nuts. My attorney hated what I was doing, by the way.
Really?
Hated.
So, you know, it is really interesting. You somewhat remind me of Rod Blagojevich. And I don't know if you remember his
yes.
story, but he did The Apprentice when he was up, you know, before he went into prison and
right.
he was waiting to see what was going to happen to him. He was very vocal and people really questioned his, you know, the way he was handling it. His attorneys were like, you have to shut up.
Right.
And he wouldn't. And he became such a big figure. Then he went away.
Right.
But this was for 14 years and Trump ended up pardoning him after 7. I got to interview him after that, and a fascinating guy, by the way, and deserves to be, you know, in front of the camera, a politician, have a book, story, whatever, because that's his personality. And it's similar to you in the way that, listen, he wanted to take responsibility for the things he did. He was very much, you know, still saying, these things I didn't do.
Right.
the things I
did do.
Right. These things I did do. And then, by the way, when you're playing a game mm-hmm. and everyone is doing this illegal thing or this thing you right. shouldn't be doing, you can't compete with them unless you are doing that illegal thing. So he's like, this is what I had to do to be a politician, right. essentially.
Sure.
So, you know, it was a very interesting way for him to handle it. But I see that for you, you are someone who wanted to take responsibility. You wanted to get it over with,
right.
You know, get that, you know, initial, you know, pain over with so that you can move on.
Correct.
And I want to get into what you want to do later and what you're going to do. But I just want to finish the conversation about Otani, because his translator, Ipe, thank you, is now in jail. And it got, what, 5 years?
57 months.
Okay. And, you know, how do you feel about that?
I feel terrible. Listen, I love money.
Yeah.
I love to make money. I love business. Mm-hmm. But I've never tried to get a customer to come bet with me. Well, first of all, they came to me anyway, but I've mm-hmm. never had a customer where I wanted to clean them dry or... Of course, I wanted to make money off of every customer I've had.
Yeah.
But it's never been about that. I've always tried to let them gamble and be entertained and afford it.
Yeah. But well, if they lose all their money, they can't be a customer anymore. So
that hurts me as well.
Right.
And then also, you know, at the end of the day, I had so many customers, I was making so much money. One guy, you know, beating himself up and you know, affecting his wife and kids, that doesn't make me feel good.
Right.
I am human. You know, I like money, but I'm human. So mm-hmm. for Ipe, I didn't know it was ever going to lead to this. I mean, people ask me, well, how'd you let this translator do this? Well, I thought it was Shohei Ohtani betting with him. I didn't know. I didn't care.
Right.
They didn't show any distray. They were, until the end, I had no idea this was even going on. But I feel terrible that his gambling addiction put this man in prison for 57 months and lost one of the best jobs you could ever have.
Yeah.
Maybe he only made $250,000. Well, only, still a lot of money. But, you know, he would, endorsements and all the things, his future were so bright. And being part of the Dodgers won the World Series, he didn't get to enjoy that.
Yeah.
Now he's in prison and he's known as a thief.
So can we talk about that? Because I definitely don't understand it. And so I think a lot of people don't understand it. This is a guy who's making $250,000 a year as an interpreter.
Right.
Right. Did he come into the picture with Ohtani? Like they knew each other from way back when or?
Not really. But they were like best friends.
Okay.
I will tell you that.
I guess they had to be because yeah. Ohtani doesn't speak English. Is that true, by the way? Who doesn't speak
now
English?
He does.
Okay.
I don't know how well he does, but he understands it from what I've been
told. Okay.
He doesn't, I don't think he's fluent, but right. he understands it.
Okay. So a guy like that, how does he get in with the big time people like you? And we're talking about know thy customer. Mm-hmm. When he's spending this money, you, as you just said, you obviously thought it was them together gambling because he would never have
that kind of money.
That kind of money. And you didn't question it, and it is what it is.
Right.
So he goes to prison because he was stealing, correct?
Correct.
How does that happen? How does no one around this guy, Ohtani, protect his money and say, where are all these millions going every week?
It's still a question that I answer honestly, and I'm going to say it again. And everyone still doesn't even believe me. I don't know the exact facts because only Shohei Ohtani and Ipe Mizuhara know exactly what occurred. But what I do know is they never bet baseball, they being that account. I do know that Ipe Mizuhara was the only person I ever spoke to. Mm. And I do know that he sent all the wires from Shohei's bank account. And I also know that there was a report that when this whole broke that has not been put out, that Tisha Thompson spoke to Ipe for 90 minutes on the phone because she was the one that came to my home.
Mm-hmm.
And that interview, I'm going to call it, which was on the phone, he said Shohei Ohtani sent the first wire transfer and knew of at least the first wire.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the details beyond that, but that I do know. Because
what was the amount of the first wire?
First one was $300,000.
Okay.
But does that mean that maybe he told his friend, hey, I'll help you out a little bit. I feel bad that you're, you know, struggling.
Right. I'll front you this,
yeah.
Whatever.
I do know this. Shohei Ohtani has been known to never gamble ever. Like, and you don't just gamble $40 million all of a sudden. You're either a gambler or you're not.
Well, was this the first time he came into that much money? I don't even.
No, I mean, he you know, first time he was making like serious money maybe,
yeah.
But the real serious money came later anyway.
Right.
But keep in mind, the money that was sent, I kind of figured this out. he had to like wait to send me wire transfers. And it was because the bank account he had access to was the Angels paychecks.
Oh, okay.
This is when he played for the Angels. The endorsement account, bank account, he didn't have access to.
Okay.
So that's where the real money was.
I see.
He was making much more in endorsements. So I don't think Shohei really, I really believe this. I don't think he really even looked at it.
Yeah.
I know that sounds wild. I don't see how someone didn't look at it for 17, 18 months. If it happened in a week or two, that'd be different.
Yeah.
So I do believe, and this is my belief, I do believe that he was aware and helped his friend a little bit. I don't think he gambled, but I think the Dodgers came in and said, look, man, let's just make this easy. You know, let's make this really, you know, clean cut and dry. You had no knowledge, and it's that simple.
Right.
That's my opinion.
Right.
I don't want to accuse anybody of anything because I think Shohei Ohtani is the most amazing baseball player to ever walk the face of the planet.
Right.
And I don't think he did anything wrong.
Right. I totally see what you're saying. There is a chance this could be the biggest cover up in Major League Baseball history. And we could find something out way later in the future.
You're right.
And it could have been something as simple as, you're right, at the beginning, like he's admitting to that at the first wire, he gambled it, Shohtani, or Ohtani, but maybe that's what gave Ipe the idea to continue doing it without him.
Plausible. I can't argue with you because I don't have any facts.
Yeah.
I just know as a gambler, you don't like go throughout your whole life and not be known to gamble and start gambling at that level.
Right.
Like I've been gambling since I was 12 or even earlier. And I've always loved to gamble. Everyone around me knows it.
Yeah.
And the people that like I know that don't gamble, they don't even have an urge to gamble. They don't even like it. They're not going to just go bet, you know, crazy amounts of money on soccer games.
Right. So that's what I want to talk about next, though, because now in a couple weeks from now, you are going to be turning yourself into prison. Gambling is an addiction and you've had to stop doing it.
Right.
How are you handling that? Have you?
You know, the fact that I go to prison if I do it is an easy deterrent.
Right.
Well, I'm going to prison, but my charges will be not only quicker, but more.
What do you get your fix on now?
My wife.
Okay.
And my business.
Okay. They always say people change their addictions into a sexual addiction.
Well, so, I've had that prior. So,
okay.
My wife is stunning. So
true. I know.
So attracted to her.
Yeah.
So, and she'll tell you that I'm like Mr. Groper on her. She's like, calm down. But truth be told, that's what makes our relationship even better. The reality is I'm just dove into my brand, my new business.
Okay, good.
And what I'm building. And almost to the point where even that's become, because I'm a all in full throttle guy, everything I've ever done. That's why I've been number one at everything I've done. I mean, I was the number one retail commodity broker in the world. I was the number one bookmaker in the world. I was Orange County Register sales or paperboy. It doesn't matter what I do it 130,000%.
Yeah. So what are you going to be the number one thing at when you get out?
I'm going to build this massive brand where I'm selling books, motivational speaking, and eventually I have I'm going to call it a community that basically follows me and I inspire and motivate people and change their lives.
Okay.
And this is the first time in my life that I've ever done something where both people are winning. I win and the person that I'm selling to wins.
I love
it's
that.
It's the first time. Whereas before it's always been commodities, I win, they got to lose. I mean, I'm trying to make them money, but I know they're going to lose because they just all lost money. And bookmaking was the same thing. I need these people to lose for me to make a living.
Right.
Now it's like I can change someone's life.
Yeah.
I can give them motivational things from stuff that I've endured that's tough or poor decisions I've made. And they can maybe not make that poor decision. Or more importantly, maybe they're afraid to take some risk. I can push them to take risk, educated, smart risk. Or enable them to lose some weight or make them change the way they treat their wife or whatever. Because I'm not perfect, but I definitely have a lot of experience and I've been very successful. So I have a lot to give. And this is the first time that I could give. And actually, I'm finding a way where I know I can make money doing it.
What's the biggest fear? And listen, I know the biggest fear has got to be leaving your wife and leaving your kids. So that is clear that that would be a fear.
Right.
But like being in prison, what is the fear?
I mean, I just don't want something to happen to escalate to where I get more time.
Right.
You know,
which, like, by the way, people talk about happening all the time.
Yeah. I mean, because I'm going to at all costs defend myself.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I'm going to let another human being, you know, harm me physically because I won't allow that.
Right.
That being said, what if someone antagonizes me? I have a big ego. I definitely don't handle disrespect very well. Thank God I'll be in a position where I just have to check myself and tell me, you know, remind myself it's not worth it. It's not worth it.
Right.
You got to put your, and just walk away or whatever. So I will diffuse every situation I can. But if someone starts putting their hands on me, I'm going to either hurt them or I'm going to get hurt. Somebody's going to get hurt.
Do you know where you're going?
Lompoc.
Okay. What do you know about it? Like, what's the living situation going to be like?
It's not pretty. It's bunks.
Okay. Know,
but I can show you a picture. I have people that are sending me pictures from Lompoc.
Oh, no way.
Currently.
Oh, no way. Yeah. So you have some automatic friends.
You know, I'm pretty popular as you are.
Yeah.
And, they're just people that.
So excited that you're coming.
I actually think some of them are.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So.
And probably some people that are resentful.
Well, of course. I mean, they're going to embrace people. There will be some people that will embrace me, but they're really not embracing me. You know, their motives are going to be.
Sure.
Opposite. So.
I have a friend who, thank God, I'm on his good side, because when you're not, he's a terrible friend, enemy to have. But Michael Lohan, are you familiar with him?
Right.
He is in prison right now.
Okay.
He gets out in a month, but he's been there for now, I want to say something like 5 or 6 months.
Okay.
I speak to him all the time, calls 3 times a week. And he is in a prison that sounds very similar to what you're going to.
What state is he in?
Right here, Palm Beach.
Okay.
And he seems like he's having the time of his life. I'll tell you that. So I've got to get him on the phone with you.
He's in a camp, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if it's called a camp or not, but similar. They have bunks.
Okay.
It's he runs a department. I forget what he does for his job. I think he helps with intake.
Okay. Yeah.
So he said
new prisoners coming in.
Yeah. So I said he said that the thing that really he loves, he gets to meet every new person that comes in. So he like starts that kind of relationship right off the bat.
Sure.
He loves that people look up to him and know that he has a platform that when they get out, they think he can help them. Whatever.
Of course.
So for him, and he's been in prison a couple times, he has not had a terrible experience. And I love getting on the phone with him because I'm always like, did you get beat up? Do you have a boyfriend? Yeah, like, yeah. Like, what's happening?
You're poking the bear.
Yeah. And he's like, what are you talking about? But he has a great story and he's working on a million things. And so it hasn't slowed him down.
Right.
And I'm sure you've done all that research to know what you're going to be doing when you're in there.
Right.
So like, will you be writing another book? Will you be like, what's the plan?
Yeah, so I'm currently, I'm here for a reason, right? People think I'm bananas because I'm not at home just whining like a baby, or more importantly, I'm trying to spend as much family time as I can, but I have to also work and I got to build my brand. So the next, you know, 23 days before I check in is work and balance of that. But in that process, I'm going to film a lot of stuff so my content will continue on my social media.
Right.
In the meantime, when I'm in prison, I'll journal every day. Of course, I'll work out. That's something I'll do all the time. Mm-hmm. But I'll write another book, and I'll use that downtime to really reset and just come back and come back as a better human.
Right.
And I'll build while I'm in there. I'll do everything I can. You don't have internet access, so to speak, but there are some tablets and things you can use that I will use to communicate with, you know, people on the outside. And I will just use every minute I can to rebuild and come out ready to go.
That's
which is what I've been doing, to be honest, the last 2 years.
Right, of course. And it gives you a whole nother chapter of your story. And not only that, I had a fascinating woman on who went to prison, came out, and she runs one of the biggest literary agencies because she found a love for writing while she was there. But then she found a love for ghostwriting.
Okay.
And so she heard all these amazing stories in prison.
Yeah.
So and she writes for these people. Now that she's out, it's not like prisoner she's writing for it, but she's made the Oprah book list like 3 times, whatever that book thing is that Oprah does. She did something with the Dalai Lama. So it's totally revamped her life, but hearing those stories and connecting with people in prison, you know, I think that can be fearful for people, but sometimes it goes the other way and you hear stories that you just learn from and you want to help tell those stories as well.
Yeah. Well, I think in life we all have, I mean, everybody has a story.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a story. Some are a little bit more wild than others. I think yours and mine have aren't the average stories. But if you learn from that adversity and you learn to take the opportunities that you get in these down times and actually elevate it, you can really do some big things. Because in that adversity or in those rough moments is when you really forge who you become.
Yeah.
I actually, in my book, there's a part I talk about this sculpture, and I'm creating that sculpture of myself now. It's like a statue I'm chipping at, and that's the ending of my book. And that sculpture, truly, over the last 2 years, I've been chipping hard at it. And the man I'm becoming now is better than the first 48 years of my life.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I love that. Tell people where they can get your book, Recalibrate. It's amazing. I was reading it as I was coming out to see you. I finished it in Panama. I mean, it's a book that everyone does need to read. And it's available now on Amazon and anywhere you can get your books.
Yeah, my website, MatthewBoyer.com. Because I haven't had time to get it in Barnes & Noble and all that stuff, I'll work on that while I'm in prison. But yeah, it's hard. I'm self-published.
Yeah.
Nobody owns my life rights, my documentary that's being filmed now. Everything I've done is I've controlled it. And that there's a reason for that. So
yeah,
I do see a movie, a feature film coming, and that's the plan. But my book is just a business card.
Right.
That's the way I look at it.
If somebody plays you in a movie, who would you want to play you?
My wife would choose Channing Tatum.
Oh, yeah, me too. she's not wrong. Yeah.
So actually, he's been in conversation with my entertainment attorneys. But I would pick Tom Hardy.
Oh.
Yeah, because I think he represents me very well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. He does jujitsu.
Yeah.
Kind of an alpha male guy, at least from what I've seen. I mean, I don't know him personally.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I would choose him.
I want to talk about the idea of restitution one more time for people to understand. You paid 1.6 back.
Yep.
What does that mean to the other, what does that mean to your bank account? You were bringing so much money in.
Right.
It
means that it hurts.
Yeah, well.
It's squealing.
But people are assuming from hearing your story that you were making, you know, whatever it was, millions of dollars a week.
Yeah.
Or a million a week, whatever.
I was making probably $1.5 million a month. On my tax return for 2023, I think I filed, I made $14.5 million.
Okay.
That being said, I lost $13 million in a casino.
Okay.
And we all know that all the money you make, I actually paid millions of dollars in taxes. People think I just didn't pay taxes.
Got it.
My tax charge in 2022, what I'm in trouble for, is a falsified tax return. It's not tax evasion. There's a big difference.
Oh, got it.
A falsified tax return means I put a wrong amount down. And the reason for that is I lost $4 million in the casino that year. But they wouldn't let me. The IRS didn't allow me to offset.
Right.
But I filed as a professional gambler, and I offset it.
Got it.
So that was an illegal charge. So I want to be clear that it wasn't like I was flipping off the government saying I'm not paying. I mean, that's why I own properties and we own things, you know.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, yeah, a lot of the money that I've made, I've spent. I've lived like a rock star.
Well, that's what I was going to say. And a lot of people don't understand that. They're like, if so much money was coming in, why doesn't he have millions stashed away?
Sure.
But a lot of it was spent on a nice lifestyle.
Very much.
I'm assuming you have property, you have cars, you have tuitions, you have all these sort of bills.
Five children.
Yeah, five children.
And we definitely were living a very exotic life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I kind of knew that this day could come.
Yeah.
And I didn't want... To be honest, I didn't want everything just to get cleaned out, and I didn't have any experiences or memories. I mean, the one thing I can do is they can take all my money, but they can't take away my memories.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
Right. But so what are you guys going to be doing as a side hustle while you're in prison to keep money in your bank account? Or is there like enough there that like just holds you? I know your wife has a clothing line.
Yeah, it's amazing. Coco on the Go. She's expanding. She's in all the montages, she's in, you know, there's spas all across the world. So her business is thriving, it's doing very well. But we also did some investments, and I still work. I even though I can't work from prison, I run a marketing for car dealerships. So there'll still be money coming in, and we'll be fine. You know, I've already covered our mortgage for a year in advance. So I've really tried to make sure that they could be very comfortable,
right,
and remain calm until I get out. But that money's going to run dry. I'm going to have to, you know, get right to work when I get out.
Right, with those speaking engagements.
Correct.
And all that.
Correct, which I'm doing in next week.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear how that goes. Okay, the last question I have to ask you, obviously, because of our show. What would you say is the most misunderstood thing about gambling, being a bookmaker, that kind of situation?
About being a bookmaker, I think people don't realize it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was a CEO of a very large corporation. It was just illegal. So it's not baseball bats and the dark alleys of beating people up. It's not. It's a business. Mm-hmm. And the misconception is basically, oh, you know, that's taboo and you could get hurt and it's violence. I mean, that happens, but it happens in any business, really. But in particular, this is really not – the gambling world today is not what it was 20, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the biggest misconception of me personally – is that I am not the guy that the media portrays. I'm not this predator that goes out and gets business just to feed the lifestyle and all that. I mean, yes, I love, nice things. I think you do too. Everybody does when they can have it.
Sure.
But I'm a father first. I'm a husband. And I'm very, when I look in the mirror, I'm very proud of who I am, despite what I'm dealing with. And I'm stronger right now going into prison at 50 years old than I ever have been in my life.
That's amazing. I wish you the best of luck. I'm going to keep in touch with you, with your wife, and make sure that, you know, you are doing well. And I got to tell you, though, I'm not scared for you because I know this is actually probably the best thing that could have happened for you because it's going to make you stronger and make you be able to have a complete new second act of life where you're doing something different and probably just as successful. So
it's absolutely correct. Thank you.
I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time. Misunderstood.